All right, actually, don't have any messages at this time, Bill, but rather we're going to turn it right over to Josh Arnold here on Connections, and Josh has next guest. Josh?
Welcome back to Connections, and our next guest is Beth Lindstrom. Beth?
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, you and I talked before the show, and I know that we're going to talk about some of the local and national politics, but I also know that you're involved in a business endeavor that's sort of new. Can you share that with us, what that's all about?
Sure, great. Thanks so much. Yeah, I'm an advisor for a company called Gentrio, and it's a Massachusetts-based online estate planning company. And actually, right now, it's pretty relevant because so many people in this pandemic are giving second thoughts to do they have their documents in place. So Gentrio actually, you know, you can go online, you can make your will, power of attorney, healthcare proxy, and believe it or not, pet care, power of attorney, which is really important. And right now we actually have an essentials employee initiative where we're waiving 80% off of the cost of it, which is affordable regardless. It's all your information is stored up in the cloud. So for folks who are listening, if they are on the front lines, you know, we appreciate everything you do. And but go check out Gentrio and take advantage of the opportunity to get your affairs, not affairs in order, but your documents in place.
Great. Now, in terms of politics, the political landscape is ever changing, and it's changed in particular with the coronavirus. Can you share some observations, what you've seen, both at the state and national level?
Well, sure. I think it impacts everybody. I mean, this is such a huge issue for people who are running for office. I mean, you look at, you know, Biden in the basement, quote unquote, you know, all politics is local, and that really prevents candidates from going out and meeting and greeting. I mean, whether that's, you know, down to the local state rep or, you know, up to running for president. It's interesting because I think when Sanders got out of the race, I mean, you know, the political news was crazy for so long about Biden, Sanders, and then all of a sudden when Sanders gets out, it was like a non-moment on the news. It was really, I thought, pretty shocking to me. But I also think that the challenge is fundraising. You know, people aren't working. As you know, so many people are on unemployment. So it's definitely impacting all our races across the board.
How likely are people to give money to a campaign that aren't working? That's, you know, very...
Right. And I think that's the challenge. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the comparisons, there are different things that had a certain life cycle that made sense given the logic of the moment, and now, in hindsight, because of the virus, put people in a bit of a frenzy. So Biden had about $20 million on hand in cash after expenses, middle, end of March, going into April. Trump had $225 million. So there's an advantage there. But Trump, on the other hand, is has the what's happening with the virus. I mean, if you looked at him 2 months ago, his biggest accomplishment was what he did to the economy, and that's been wiped out.
But I would argue, though, Josh, that if we hadn't been in such a good position in the economy, where would we be today? Much worse off, I believe. And I think, you know, people have, because they've had increased money in their pockets, a little wherewithal, maybe some of this storm. But, you know, and I'm a small business owner also. I've got 11 employees in a small business, and, you know, they are employees. They are collecting unemployment. They're getting those extra stimulus checks or rescue checks, as I would call right now. Yep. And we've applied for a loan, and we're going to get some of that money and put them back on payroll. But, you know, we're probably not typical of most small businesses. I mean, there are going to be a lot that are hurt. And so, again, how does that contribute to the political campaigning?
Josh, can I interject here for one question?
Sure.
Okay, and I know you want to get back to that. And Beth, first of all, I remember when we first talked with you, you mentioned, we wanted a senator in this state who was working for Massachusetts and not running for president. And that still resonates with me because she declared so early. But in terms of the way the governor or governors, period, have handled this situation, what are your observations with respect to the federal government's involvement and then the local government, particularly Governor Baker?
Well, you know, that is really interesting. Having sat on Governor Romney's cabinet and preparing for the bird flu at one point, you know that there are initiatives that you have to do at a state level. There are the partnerships that you have at the federal level, and then you have at the local level. And I think for someone like Charlie Baker, who has been a selectman before, understands kind of all, you know, certainly those two levels and how they interplay with each other. And, you know, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal today, I think, about, you know, does Trump have the absolute right? And it was a good article that talked about, you know, the president has rights when the states and the feds are doing the same things. Does the Fed supersede? It does in some areas. That's how it is in some regulation. So, you know, because sometimes you have state regulation, Fed regulation, you know, who supersedes? So, but I think the bottom line and what people want to see is our government working for them and working together. And so I think it's great that the president is out front there with his briefings. I mean, you know, it's always colorful, but nonetheless, he's out there talking about and trying to give hope. You don't want a president who's not giving hope, right? But you have to be realistic and you have to listen to those scientists. Then, you know, coming down to the state level, it's smart for our governors to coalesce together and to say, okay, you know, we are a region. How do we deal with this? Because people don't just sit home. They travel. Where do they go? Just like anything in commerce. So I think for the average consumer, the person who's sitting home in there right now saying, when can we get out? They look to these leaders. And that's what it is. It is about leadership. And some will succeed, governors, in reopening their states, and some will fail. And the proof will be in the pudding when we see how that rolls out.
Josh?
What are the things that you and I talked about, Beth, and I've said this in as an advisor in political campaigns. I talked about the strength of one's support, and I always use the Hellman's mayonnaise example, and that was I happen to like Hellman's mayonnaise. If I went to the store and they didn't have it, I wouldn't buy Cane's or substitute. I'd go to the store that had Hellman's and get it. That's the highest form of product brand preference that there is. Ideally, that's what you want to have as a candidate, be it for election or re-election. You want to have a solid backing. And you made the observation about the ups and downs of candidates, presidents in the several elections, given the ups and downs of the economy, the wars, and so forth. But that Donald Trump tracked a little bit different. Can you share with us what
sure.
that was about?
Yeah. I think there was a couple months ago, Pew Research came out and they had, they tracked past presidents, Republicans and Democrats, probably for the last 20 years, and they showed their favorability rating, and they are always tied to external events. And so it was interesting when you looked at all these presidents and, you know, through their chronological timeline, you had, you know, kind of the up and down, the bellwether up and down. And then Trump's was steady across all the years he's been president. And I think that that's a very telling, because that shows that his base is so solid of people who are just have the same belief system or who he's speaking to with his, whether it's Make America Great Again or whatever his narrative is. And you didn't see that with any other president in history. So I think that really tells us that he does have a strong base through thick or thin. And we know that government right now is so polarizing. So the person sitting at home is, you know, whether it's cat or whether it's, you know, impeachment, it's they're getting a sense of, okay, can we just let our president be president and, you know, finally get through all of that. Now it's this pandemic. And then, of course, the rescue bill and the first stimulus. But it's, I think that people are becoming more astute to what's happening. And what I'm trying to get to is that he has a solid base. I think that's only going to go up or, you know, stay the same even through this pandemic. Because everyone always says, you know, what's going to happen in the 2020 election? And I think there's a lot of people out there who probably support the president, maybe doesn't support his behaviors and so forth, but they don't, and when the polling doesn't really show. So I think there's about a 5% bump in polling that you'd see also if you ask those questions about reelecting the president.
Well, I think the polling thing is off anyway for a couple of reasons. One is, I asked the question, are these the same polls that said Hillary's going to win by 10 or 12 points as much as a month or 3 weeks before the election? Part of the problem I saw from the polling in 2016 was that I didn't see, you didn't get into the, they didn't show you what the mechanics of the validity test were, but I questioned how valid they were. I mean, when I've done polling in the past, and we'd come up with a validity question like, did you vote in the past state election or municipal election? And if they said yes, you went back and checked, and if they didn't, you had to exclude that. And I'm not sure how valid some of the mechanics are on the one hand.
Right.
On the other side of it, I think a lot of people were intimidated by being supporters of Trump. They didn't want to be, you know, somehow someone was going to record that, and that was, so they kept it. They didn't say who they were going to vote for, or they lied. And I don't think there's a bump that comes off of every poll that says, okay, yeah, this is what they said they were going to do. What are they, you know, what's the piece that we don't know? And it stretches beyond the margin of error because it's
I agree.
An error. It's a deliberate error, and that you can't calculate. What happens with the vice presidential selection? What does Biden have to do now? I'd ask the question, you know, if you were to pick the ideal person, if the ideal person was the person most qualified to step in as president, if something happened to Joe Biden, you might have won selection.
Sure. I think, first of all, the vice president has already said he's going to pick a woman for vice president. So assuming that that's going to be a female, you know, who could that possibly be? And, you know, the names have been, you know, bantered around. But I think if he does land on Amy Klobuchar, I think she would be the best suited to go and to step in because she has had a lot of experience. She's worked with a lot of Republicans in the Senate. She's worked with Biden before. I think she seems more authentic than a Kamala Harris. I think Kamala would be, you know, she would be asked to be vice president and could certainly step in. But when you ask the question, who is the most ready, I think Amy Klobuchar would be that person I would suggest if you're asking for a strict answer.
No, that's fine. If you look at some of the people that they've taken in the past, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush took Dan Quayle. And I've said, you know, sometimes it looked like presidents bought a life insurance policy because no one was going to take the president out because of who would succeed them. And whether you liked George H.W. or George W., they were much better than their vice presidents for different reasons. That's why I wondered if, Nixon took Spiro Agnew because he was an attack dog for him. And I wondered if Biden might go take Liz Warren or Kamala Harris to be the attack dog. But I also know that you need some regional balance in there, and that wouldn't work for Biden, as Delaware doesn't have it's what, two or three electoral votes? It's not, you know,
right, but he's already got the name. He's already been vice president, so I think, you know, that's kind of a, you know, you do that to garner votes. So I don't.
They're going
to
take New York and they're going to take California anyway. So it doesn't really have to take one of those people. But he needs to get somebody who's going to he's be able to work with and yet not upstage him either. Cuomo's name keeps getting floated out there, even though he says no. But I thought it was interesting that they ran the Bernie endorsement announcement at the same time as the Cuomo conference. I don't know if anybody else picked up on that, but I did.
Sure. You know what if we have a couple of minutes, I'd like to actually go back to talking about signatures locally too, if we get a moment. But
sure.
But I think for Cuomo, I mean, not for nothing, but you don't know. You and I have been in this business long enough that you never know what's going to happen in politics. And if something happens to Biden for some reason, you know, the Democrats may say, okay, you know, is his number two going to be the most enthusiastic and bring excitement to this race? If they're not feeling that, you know, you never know whether they might, I don't know if they can in their party rules, but, you know, after this pandemic is over, you don't know whether they'll draft Cuomo to like yeah. take the number one. So we never know what's going to happen, and really they can bend rules because we've seen it in the past, you know, with delegate selection and so forth to fit the purpose. But I agree with you. I think I don't know what's going to happen, especially with Elizabeth Warren. I mean, you saw that she did the final endorsement. I think her timing certainly was too late in the game. But on the other hand, does she bring those progressives to the party? And there's even debate about that after what she did to Sanders with the, you know, statement about you said a woman could never win the presidency. And that really divided the two progressive camps. So you wonder whether even if he does go after Warren as a pit bull and someone who is very smart, you know, on policies, just not likable at all. So yeah. you know, there's weighing all those factors about each person. And, you know, would she be that right person to bring that policy part of it? But I kind of doubt it, truly. I think they would be thinking about somebody else who's more likable but is going to bring more to the table in the flyover states, or someone who's just going to bring a demographic to the table.
You mentioned signatures, and I meant to bring that up earlier. I know that I've seen the article about Joe Kennedy, who's running on the Democratic side for Senate to go from Congressman to Senate, against Ed Markey, the incumbent. And Markey's got a problem because he doesn't have enough signatures, and the pandemic has impacted that. But it's also filters down to people, other people running for state and federal office, too. Do you have any sense of how that's going to play out? Are they going to relax the standards, or is the state legislature the one that has to make that decision, and are they going to kind of take care of their own by discouraging competition, or I don't know?
But any only event happening today, but the legislature, you know, waited so long to even think about putting forth a bill to lower the state, or some thwarting of that. But in the meantime, there's three people: Kevin O'Connor, who's running for U.S. Senate; Robert Goldstein's running for Congress; and Melissa Bauer Smith, who's a state rep candidate, who's, you know, got autoimmune issues. And Goldstein's an infectious doctor, and they all coalesced to actually bring an emergency petition for relief to the Supreme Judicial Court, and that's being the arguments are being heard today at 2 p.m. Actually, you can go to suffolk.edu or something and watch it. But I think that's going to be very telling because Maura Healey has already agreed, I believe, I don't know if I'm telling tales out of school, but that because she would have to defend the legislature, or Galvin, who's listed in this this suit. And I think she already has said that she believes it is unconstitutional. So what I think is going
she
to
happen... She thinks it's unconstitutional?
Yes. Trying to get signatures out, to collect signatures right now in this pandemic. When you look at the social distancing orders and the shutdown orders, yeah. You put that all together, and it is really creating hardship. But I think to your point, it didn't go through the legislature because they, as always, you know, believe that, geez, people are sitting at home and they're unemployed. We don't want anybody to run against us.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I really think that's the reason why they waited so long, and then now, you know, I'm not quite sure they're even going to get to a vote. But if they but because of this suit that's happening today, the hearing, that maybe they'll coalesce and make a decision so they don't look like they've, usurped their responsibility, but nonetheless. So we'll see what's happening. So that is actually going to happen 2 p.m. today, those hearings, and get a judgment from the court.
Great. Well, how much time? We're right about on the clock, so we're just about ready to wrap up, I believe. Want to thank you for being a guest and sharing us with us your business endeavor, but also all the insight you've given us about the state and national elections.
My pleasure. Always nice to talk with you guys.